The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I feel like this is the trilogy. But Godfather 3, by the way, it was a good movie. I mean, yes, they had to deal with some stuff with the Andy Garcia, Sofia Coppola. You know, what am I doing? I am back. This is the final part of our Carlo Estates interview. And I'm joined now by the winemaker at Carlo Estates, Spencer Mayer. Spencer, thanks so much for being part of the podcast.
My pleasure. First time actually doing this thing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I've never been on a podcast or interviewed like this before. So
then how comfortable are you talking about you?
I don't do it very often. So, I mean, this is actually a pretty, once in a lifetime opportunity. So.
No. You're gonna be doing tons of these. You were actually saying you're heading to Ottawa tomorrow for an event. I mean, it must be. How common is it for you going out and talking to people about you and about the wines here at Carlo?
I do it a few times a year. So usually in and around the spring, early summer. You know, there's a few events going on there that I attend, and then usually around this time of year. You know, the end of harvest. You know, going into the holiday season. You know, they'll have a few events as well that I attend. I've been doing the events in Ottawa with Savvy Company. They're the folks who run it. I've been doing that since I started working here. So, you know, I'm going on seven seasons now. So it's kind of a tradition for me to go up that way.
Okay. Well, I want to get into just your own background and how you got here. But let's start as we're recording this. This podcast will be out probably sometime in early December. But today it is November 16th. It's 8:26 in the morning and there's a lot of activity. What is a day like today like for you and for the workers when technically the harvest is done, but you still have so much work ahead of you?
So this is a late season for sure. So this is probably one of the latest seasons that I've had here so far. You know, like I said, I've been here for seven seasons or going on seven seasons now. So I'm actually still fermenting a couple totes of wine here. So I thought
I smelled that when we came in here. You could smell the fermentation.
Yeah. So there's some Merlot and some Malbec fermenting here still. So we still have to press that off, tuck that away, et cetera, et cetera. And then I still have obviously wines in other various stages of tucking and not being tucked away yet. And, you know, the work is far from over yet. So
what was this vintage like? You're saying this is one of the latest. You guys are still fermenting stuff.
This has been what I would say a strange vintage, because I wouldn't say that it was, you know, just rainy and cold. I wouldn't say it was hot and dry, you know, like drought. It was kind of a little bit of everything. And sometimes when you get a little bit of everything, you don't know how it's going to pan out in the end, you know, come harvest season. So obviously this harvest season, things took a little bit longer to ripen, took a little bit longer to get in and harvested off the vines, and here I am now. So
yeah. You know, so. And the workers outside, you were saying before, pruning and stuff going on?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So in Prince Edward County, we tuck away the vines for the season. A lot of folks are already done that process, but because we're a very small team here, we're a very small crew, and, you know, industry-wide resources are getting more and more limited as time passes. And, you know, it's harder and harder to find folks to do the work, you know, because it is hard work.
Yes.
Very hard labor. You know, you're kind of at the mercy of availability, you know, sometimes of those folks. So here we are.
Is it a lot of the same workers that come in year after year? Because I always hear about how important that is for them having familiarity with the vineyards.
Yeah. So we typically work with the same folks year in, year out. We don't like to hire new people every year if we can help it. I mean, obviously, sometimes that's a necessary thing that you have to do to get the work done, but typically we hire the same folks every year, and the same folks come back every year. So yeah, there is that familiarity. They kind of know what we're after, what we're looking for to get the job done. So yeah.
You mentioned before we started, you're born or raised folks in Stony Creek. Is that where you first learned to love wine? Obviously, Stony Creek, not that far from the bench, Niagara-on-the-Lake. So there's a lot of wine appellations there.
So actually, I didn't really start getting into wine until I was attending University of Waterloo. So when I was off to study geography, environmental studies, actually, that's kind of where I started getting into wine, because, you know, being a student, you know, with your OSAP loan coming in, being a little bit, you know, that first taste of freedom that you get moving out of your parents' house and living on res or living around campus. And you get that money in your pocket, it's burning a hole in your pocket a little bit. However, I like to think that I spent it a little bit more responsibly, because instead of just going out and blowing it on party favors, let's call it, I would go out, I would spend the money on a nice bottle of wine. I would take it home and I would try to like learn about it. I would, because I'm a bit of a geek. I'm a self-professed geek in general, you know, not just about wine. I would say I'm very passionate about things when I become interested in them.
Yes.
And that's kind of how my interest in wine started. So I would take it home. I would read wine blogs. I would watch the old Gary Vaynerchuk videos, Wine Library TV.
Yep.
You know, whatever.
YouTube,
early YouTube days type of stuff. So
you're a total nerd. By the way, I love those Gary videos. Just the energy that he has, and just, you know, just throw his nose into five different glasses and come up with 47 different adjectives.
You know, as much as we like to make fun of those videos and some of the older, you know, wine media mm-hmm. that we'll find on the internet if you dig around, I have to give him a lot of credit.
Oh, hell yeah.
For getting me into that. So, you know, especially as a young guy in university who knew nothing at that point, you know.
Okay, I want to go back here. So you went and bought wine, but what was the motivation for that? When you're starting in university, you're somewhere between 19 and 21 years old, and usually it would be beer, it would be coolers, Purple Jesus. Of course, I think I'm dating myself by making a Purple Jesus reference.
Oh, there was that going on too.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. No, there was especially actually whiskey. Whiskey's probably my second favorite beverage mm-hmm. after wine. So there is a lot of that going on as well.
But then what made you go to the fine wine section at the LCBO?
Probably how I was brought up, actually. So, you know, I mean, we're a Canadian family through and through. I mean, neither of my parents immigrated or anything like that. But I would say, especially my dad's family, kind of have that more European kind of style, lifestyle.
Yeah.
So my grandfather is from Austria. My grandma is from England. They kind of just have a very like European kind of household, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I would go over there at 16 years old and I would have wine with dinner, for example. You know, so it was kind of just a normal thing for us growing up. You know, it wasn't something that was like a strange or like taboo or anything like that. So, you know, I kind of grew up with wine being a normal thing or an okay thing. So, and then, you know, just, you know, being in university and again with the freedom, you know, kind of just curiosity,
right,
know, kind of came into the picture there. So, yeah.
So then it goes from you're getting the wines, you're learning about it, reading the blogs, listening to Gary yammer on and on about Nebbiolo.
Yeah.
And then you're studying geography and environmental science. At what point then did you make the move where you decided it was fully into wine? And by the way, I appreciate what you were saying about just the passion. I have an expression: if you like everything, you love nothing. It's right. Here are the things I love, and I'm going to go full into that, which means other things are going to be out of my life now, but I'm totally good with that.
Yeah, it's all about checks and balances, right, when it comes to interests and mm-hmm. investing yourself in something. And wine is definitely one of those things where you have to go all in,
yeah,
you know, if you want to make a career or a job out of it. So, the transition into going all in. So when I graduated Waterloo, you know, Waterloo has the co-op program that they're kind of famous or maybe infamous for now mm-hmm. at this point. I kind of learned the hard way, especially in my senior years at Waterloo, that geography, environmental science, or environmental studies was not really their priority. Let's put it nicely. And I kind of learned that the hard way. And then in the co-op, there wasn't really a lot of support there,
right,
you know, to actually go out and find a co-op position. And I actually ended up getting a co-op position that was very, very, very loosely related to my major.
What was
it was like working for like this nonprofit organization. It was more of like a social justice kind of like group mm-hmm. more than it was like environmentally focused. So it was loosely related, but it wasn't really what I was after,
right,
you know, to put it nicely or diplomatically. So so basically when I graduated, I was like, well, you know what, I mean, they have this college program, you know, at Niagara College Canada, and it's only two and a half years, because they also have a co-op part of that as well. And I'm a glutton for punishment, you know. I'm still in school, so it's not like I'm graduated, I'm out in the work world, and I'm coming back to it. Not to say that's not okay too, because there's a lot of those folks who were part of the Niagara College program. But I decided to just kind of tack that on to the end of my my post-secondary studies. And it kind of just seemed like a good fit. It was closer to where my folks live, so I could live at home, not have to spend money on, you know, living there, and et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that's kind of how I, you know, moved into making it a bigger part of my life.
Because you started here in, I think it was 2017.
Yeah.
At Carlow Estates. What did you know about Carlow? What did you know about Peck when you first were coming out here?
first heard whispers of this region, this sub-appellation, I guess, when I was in the Niagara College program. Mm-hmm. So when everybody was talking about getting their co-op placements, a couple of the students that I was with got their placements up here in Prince Edward County. The one that stood out to me at the time was the Grange.
Right.
Of yeah. Prince Edward.
Yeah, Carolyn. Yeah, she was, yeah.
Yeah, so one of my classmates went there and worked there, and that was the focus of his co-op and his after projects, you know, involved with that. So that's kind of where I first, you know, really kind of heard about it. But obviously they also introduced wines, you know, from the various regions in Canada, you know, to us in the tasting courses and so on. So, you know, there was a little bit of some introduction there while I was at Niagara College.
How different are you now as a winemaker versus those final days coming out of school? Like, I mean, you're still, you know, relatively young, and I mean, it must have been a pretty exciting learning curve over the last 5-6 years.
Well, you know, I worked at a couple of different wineries, you know, before I got here.
Yeah. Where'd you work?
So I guess my first job in the industry was at what was formerly called Kittling Ridge Estate Wines and Spirits, now 40 Creek Distillery in Grimsby. Mm-hmm. So that was my very first job in the business. I had nothing to do with the actual production or anything like that.
But what were some of the worst jobs? What were some of the toughest jobs you did?
That was my first job in the industry. So I was about 22 at the time, and I had to lead tours.
Right. Yep.
So and that is a big facility, a very popular, even back then it was a very popular facility. So there would just be these big groups of people who are very, very passionate fans of 40 Creek whiskey and even the other spirits that they made back then. And, you know, I was just kind of like, you know, dipping my toes in the water as far as being a professional goes a little bit there. So it was a little bit intimidating. It was a little bit overwhelming. Apparently I did an okay job. I mean, I never got reprimanded for doing poorly. So
there you go.
I mean, you know, there is that. You know what they always say in the business, fake it until you make it. And there is a little bit of that going on, especially when you start out.
Mm-hmm. Derek Barnett, just his influence. I mean, that must be a cool person to be working with.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, one of the things that drew me to come to Carlo Estates is that I knew that Derek Barnett was working here, mm-hmm. Working with them. And he's actually who I interviewed for this position originally. So, you know, Sherry is the one who reached out to me, you know, say, hey, we have a job opening, you know, in the production side of our business here, you know, assistant winemaker. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, of course. And then, oh, by the way, you're going to be interviewing with Derek Barnett, you know, the one and only.
Yeah.
You know, and at that point, I was a little bit starstruck because, you know, he's another person who we talked about while I was at Niagara College, you know, back in the Lely days, you know, for
yes.
him. Me and a couple of the other classmates would sneak out, you know, in between classes and go out and buy wine, you know, at the, you know, closer places to campus. And, you know, being where it was, we would try to go out down to Lely and buy, you know, some of those wines. So, you know, we were definitely fans.
They were, it was the first 100% Ontario Cabernet that I liked. Was a Lely back in like 2013 or around there. And I was surprised because I had the prejudice. I'm like, oh, here comes a green, stocky, you know, just yep. going to be a green bell pepper mess. And instead, just full-bodied and red fruit and dark fruit, and it was all there. That was one that really turned my eyes to what Ontario could do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's definitely like that turning point, I mm-hmm. think, like in the history of the industry, you know, where, you know, sometime in the 2000s, I want to say, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of went from, you know, the infancy, you know, trying to figure things out, you know, the awkward stage, you know, into what it is now, you know, which is, you know, pretty serious. You
yeah.
know? And world renowned, you know, in one way or another, and, you know, world class. So.
Well, a lot of it just comes down to a really boring answer. Why are we better at it? And I was saying this in the other podcast, is that the vines got older and people got smarter. Because it just takes time. What to pick, what grapes to use, what grapes not to use. That just takes decades of experience.
Yeah, for sure. And I give Derek a lot of credit, you know, for, you know, my skills that I've gained and how I am as a winemaker now. But, you know, there's little bits and things that I've picked up along the way too. So, you know, Kittling Ridge is where I started. I also worked at Calamus Winery mm-hmm. briefly. I also worked at Ravine Vineyard in Niagara-on-the-Lake there. And then I actually worked out east in Nova Scotia for a vintage at Benjamin Bridge Winery. They're known for sparkling wine mostly, but they kind of started transitioning more into table wine now. And they were also doing some orange wine. So very cool things out there. And that's actually probably the more diverse terroir experience I've had, you know, in my career so far. So
how would, and you know, it's going to change in some bigger question. How would you describe yourself as a winemaker?
The two main, I would say, camps of winemakers is you have like the more scientific winemakers who are very like by the numbers. They're very by the books. They're very precise and calculated, like with their methods. They're very easily capable of repeating results over and over and over again. So typically when you get winemakers working at larger wineries, you know, right, that's kind of like what they're after. And that's kind of the type of winemaker that they're after, because they want to be able to repeat those results year in and year out. I would say I'm kind of somewhere in the middle where, you know, you have that, but then you also have the other type of winemaker who's more artistic, I guess. A little more, what's the word I'm looking for? A little avant-garde, mm-hmm, you know, a little more palate driven. And I know Sherry and Sachs like to talk about that with Derek a lot, you know, that he's a palate-driven winemaker. I'm like, at the end of the day, I think we're all palate-driven, you know, in one way or another, but maybe more than others. But I would say I'm kind of somewhere in the middle, because that's kind of, you know, when you start in Niagara College and when they're teaching you, you know, how to make wine, it is very number-driven.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very textbook, and it's very like, you know, this is the one way to do it. And, you know, like that's the problem, right, is you get teachers coming in there from the industry, you know, from various parts of the industry, and they're going to teach you, they're going to indoctrinate you with the one way that they know how to do something, and that works for them. You know, one of the things that I've also learned kind of the hard way is there is no one way to do anything in this industry, you know, as a winemaker. There's multiple ways to get to the same endpoint.
It's always a tough dance, because on one level you want to be scientific and by the numbers, because this is still a product that you need to sell. On the other level, you want the wine to represent the terroir and also represent the vintage. And there's a scary thing about that, because it means you don't have control. You don't get to know, okay, we're going to be being able to make X amount of cases, and we know the flavor profile will be this. It also relies on the customer to be okay with not having consistency, which is sort of the opposite of say, scotch.
Yeah, right. And I think that kind of all comes down to the winery, once again. It's like the winery and the business model and, you know, the region where it's located. You know, all these, like, variables kind of all kind of come together. And then that is kind of what dictates to the customer, you know, like, what kind of like what to expect, you know, as far as that goes. So are you going to get consistency from year to year, or are you going to get, you know, that variable aspect to it where, you know, every vintage is different and every wine made every year is going to be a little bit different. I mean, obviously there's going to be some level of consistency, you know, between varietals,
of course,
and, you know, between producers and winemakers and so on and so forth. But, you know, really, you know, when you're looking at small boutique wineries or smaller producers, you're going to get more variability there, you know, even in their blended products, you know. And that's kind of like something that, you know, the customer would eventually come to expect, you know, being a fan of that particular winery.
Speaking of variety, you play with all the varieties, the Bordeaux blends, and it's certainly different. Like when, and I know that some of the grapes are sourced from Niagara, some of them are county fruit. What's that like for you? Just the blending, because with you guys, your wines, you're known for using all of them: Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Cab Franc, all the Bordeaux varietals.
I would say it's both a blessing and a curse. So it's a blessing that because I get to place it with so many different grape varietals. Like, you know, there's a lot of wine, especially here in Prince Edward County, a lot of wineries here just get to play with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Yeah.
You know, or that's like their main focus. And, you know, they might play with some Gamay, they might play with some Cabernet Franc here and there, you know, but for the most part, the vast majority, the bulk of the volume that they're producing is Pinot and Chardonnay. And those are fantastic varietals, don't get me wrong. But I have to say, as somebody who is young, you know, and still relatively in my infancy of my career, you know, it is kind of fun to be able to work with all these different grape varietals, you know, and see what they bring to the table, see all the differences, and get to make them, you know, every year, and see some of the consistencies and the differences, you know, that they bring every season. But it's also a curse, because, you know, sometimes it's just a damn shame that you have to put that into a blend. But
right,
that's where I have to remind myself, you know, why I'm here, what I'm doing. For those folks looking for that consistency from year to year, that's the reason why we blend wines,
mm-hmm,
is because we're looking for the consistency, and we're looking for those products that, you know, folks can kind of depend on, you know, every time they walk in the door here, you know, so.
And I was wondering if we go over some of the profile, the Sextus, the Quatrus. I was wondering if you could just tell people a little bit about some of the different Bordeaux blends, Gemini, like that you guys make.
The whole series of blends that we make is that kind of whole stepping stone to that final wine, that Sextus wine, which, mm-hmm, is all six of the original Bordeaux grape varietals. So, you know, you have the Carmenere, which is what we grow here, which is a quite rare variety.
Yeah.
Really hard to find. And, of course, we blend it. So we have made it into a single varietal wine, but I'll go back to that later. So there's Petit Verdot, there's Malbec, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, and they all kind of have this unison dance, you know, where they're all kind of like lending their qualities to the final wine. And really, over and above the Quintus, which is lacking in the Carmenere, the Sextus has that little bit of brightness that the Carmenere lends, because not only is it, you know, it's kind of like Cabernet Franc in a lot of ways, like cool climate Carmenere. I mean, if you get Carmenere from Chile at the LCBO, it's nothing like what we grow here.
Yeah.
And you can say that for pretty much any grape varietal, you know, grown in Ontario versus other places in the world. But our Carmenere is much more like a Cabernet Franc. So you have like those herby kind of notes, like dried kitchen herbs, a little bit of that bell peppery. I find there's a like kind of a red citrus, like a blood orange kind of characteristic, you know, that you get in the Carmenere as well. Just very unique. And it has a little bit more acidity than some of those other Bordeaux grapes. So when you add that to the final blend of Sextus, I would say you're harmonizing it a little bit better and you're adding a little bit more balance to the blend over and above, say, the Quintus, which is only lacking in the Carmenere. So
what do you look for when you're doing your blend? Because percentages will always change depending on the vintage and things like that. I'm always curious about that. Like between you and Derek, what are sort of the discussions that go into what the final percentage will be?
And honestly, there's not a lot of discussion that happens. It kind of just all naturally falls into place. I know that's kind of a weird thing to say, but there isn't really a whole heck of a lot of analysis that goes into it, because for whatever reason, it just kind of like falls into place naturally. There's not a lot of like going back and forth, like too much. I mean, obviously there's a little bit of discussion. I don't want to say that it's all telepathic or anything like that. You know, naturally it kind of just happens where, you know, like for example, Merlot makes up a lot of the bulk of a lot of the blends, just because Merlot is like a nice blank canvas to work with.
Right.
Like everybody likes to rag on Merlot because of that stupid Sideways movie.
Which by the way, what was he drinking at the end? He was drinking Merlot. He was drinking a Cheval Blanc. A right bank wine.
How ironic is that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. Merlot is just wonderful to work with because it's a nice canvas to work with. It's got good structure. It's got good fruit. It's inoffensive in many ways. And it makes, like you say, it makes some of the most world-class wines out there,
yeah,
you know, most renowned anyway. So it's a good starting point. And then you're kind of like adding the building blocks to that, you know? So all these various blends have different proportions of the different other varietals, you know, that kind of change and morph them. And they'll all be different every single season too. I mean, like this year's Gemini has Cabernet Franc and Merlot. But we've made Geminis in the past that were Malbec and Carmenere, for example. Or the next one might be Petit Verdot and Malbec, you know? Like, it's, you know, sky's the limit. It's just whatever two varietals, you know, that kind of didn't make it into all the other blends, you know? And that's not to say that they're not fantastic, exceptional wine. It's just, it kind of just worked out that way.
Yeah.
So because we make all these different blends, there's kind of like just limitless possibilities of like what we can put into a bottle. And we only put things into a bottle that I would say that we're all proud of. You know, we would never put our label on it if we didn't all agree that it was a fantastic wine.
Yeah. So. And by the way, nothing wrong with a second wine. Just go look at some of the prices of some of the second wines in Bordeaux. So what have you been most tempted to, you've just wanted to secretly make 100% of? Like, because you sort of mentioned before, you get tempted, you're like, it's a shame this has to go into the blend.
Well, I mean, I think at one point or another, we've made single varietals of all of these different grapes, you know, through the winery's history. You know, I think we've done a straight Cabernet Sauvignon. We've done straight Petit Verdot. We've definitely done straight Malbec.
Straight Petit Verdot.
Yeah.
That'd be a big wine.
Yeah, they call it the fifth element here because it's the fifth, I guess, varietal that gets used in both Quintus and Sextus.
Mm-hmm.
So they call it the fifth. Yeah, we've definitely made those wines in the past. I think 2016 was the last vintage that we did it as a single varietal, and that was a big, big vintage as well. So definitely a big wine. And I actually think there might be a bottle or two hiding away in here somewhere. So
that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
I saw in your Instagram account recently, you had an addition to the punch down method you had your son helping you out. How'd that go?
You know what? So my son,
how old?
He's 3 years old. Mm-hmm. He's going to be four in March of next year. So he's, I would say, like three and a half. So he is very curious and he's very capable for a three-year-old. Like he always surprises me. So at home, he always helps out in the kitchen with cooking and baking. He helps out with all the yard work. You know, he insists on helping with the leaf blower and the rake. And he definitely wants to help with the lawnmower, but he's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
He's not quite able to push that himself. So, but he's absolutely interested in all of those things. So he's just really, he just has that curious mind where he just wants to know all the hows and whys of how things work. And anytime he comes visits me at work here at the winery, he just is always asking all these questions. And I'm like, well, what better time to, you know, show him, you know, what I do, you know, than during harvest when there's red wine fermenting. And these wines were almost done fermenting, so there wasn't much of a cap to them. So it was the perfect opportunity to show him how to do a punch down. So, you know, they weren't like these bins of Merlot and Malbec behind me fermenting now with mm-hmm. a, you know, cap almost as long as your forearm.
Yeah.
and just kind of, you know, in the middle of fermentation. So it was a good learning opportunity for him for sure. And, you know, my wife is always supportive of that too for him. So
how much sleep do you get? You got someone turning four, you're making wine. How much sleep do you get?
Not enough. I mean, it depends. Like if you're talking about like an industry-wide thing, probably I get about the average amount, which
okay.
is, you know, probably about five and a half hours a night, you know, mm-hmm. which is, you know, sometimes I get more, sometimes I get less, you know, depends on what's going on and how busy and hectic the day was. So I would say on average, probably 5.5 hours.
How many days a year are you able to turn your mind off and not think about making wine, fermenting wine, or anything about wine?
Never.
Never.
Never. So like I said before, you know,
you're on vacation and it's you're thinking about Malbec.
I can't help it.
Yeah,
you can't help it. And like once you get to this point, like where you're, you know, it's your career basically.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really turn it off.
Yeah,
you can't really, like, you know, you might be able to turn it off where you're not talking about it, you know, to the folks around you, because you know, any of like my family, you know, my wife, you know, they'll all tell you that I talk about it too much. So, you know, so you got to definitely learn how to turn that part of it off. But as far as up in the old, in the brain goes, you know, you're always thinking about it, you know, in some way.
But your family must love you. I mean, you've probably upped their whole wine game. You're probably bringing nice bottles and they're probably intimidated to bring wine over at Christmas or Thanksgiving.
You know, it's kind of funny. So my wife is not as intensely into the wine, like whole industry and the whole world of wine as I am.
Mm-hmm.
But she's very open-minded, you know, and she's always kind of been that way. But she's always open-minded to try new things. So if I open an old bottle of Pinot Noir, you know, it's been sitting on the wine rack for years and years, you know, she'll try that. You know, if I bring a new wine home that we've never had before, she'll try it. So, I mean, I have to give her a lot of credit, you know, for kind of just going with the flow and, you know, being there to try things with me and experiment with wines and, you know, decanting and stuff, all that stuff. Like,
yeah.
She's open, she's game for everything, you know, yeah. And also with the food pairings as well.
Who wouldn't be game to old Pinot? So I'm not going to ask you to go back to your old job when you used to do tours. But if there was a tour here and you were going to give the introductory couple paragraphs of what Carlo Estates is, the philosophy and sort of the style of the wines, how would you describe it?
That's actually a really good question. When I get asked about the history of Carlo Estates, I mean, you have to talk about Richard.
Yes.
You know, Richard Carlo, like this was his love child, you know, like this was his experiment. And, you know, he was basically transitioning from being like a home winemaker, whatever you want to call it, a garage winemaker, you know, and he wanted to kind of bring it to the big leagues. You know, and this was his vessel for that. You know, so I mean, really, at the end of the day, we're just kind of all collectively hoping that, you know, we're doing him proud. You know, so that the one regret I have working here at Carlo Estates is that I never got to meet Richard Carlo.
Yeah.
That's I would say the one thing, because everybody talks about Richard Carlo just being this huge personality, having his own way of, you know, doing things. And, you know, he had all these visions and he had all these ideas. And, you know, obviously not all of them came to fruition, unfortunately. But I'm hoping that all the things that we're doing, like with the Sextus, you know, with the Quintus, with all these different varietals, all the techniques and methods, I'm hoping that we're doing them proud.
And that must, you know, I talked to Derek about it, about the pressure, but also the joy of being able to keep the vision alive. And that's got to be really motivating for all of you, motivating for all you guys in terms of wanting to do as good a job as you can.
You know, I try not to think about that too much.
Yeah. 'Cause,
you know, the pressure's already on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I try to, you know, kind of just do what I do and do it to the best of my ability. I mean, the philosophy I carry with me, you know, no matter if I was here, if I was at any other winery, would be, I just want to make the best wine possible with the grapes that we have come in.
Yeah.
You know, and really that if I just adhere to that and I kind of like live that every single day that I come in to work, I believe that I am indirectly kind of carrying the legacy along, because I mean, how much more can you ask for from a winemaker, really? Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, I know it's a very kind of like blanket kind of statement, but you know, it's a good general philosophy I think to carry you. So.
And last question: when your son is old enough to be driving a car, where would you like to be? You know, I was talking to Brooke Husband, assistant winemaker at K-Luce, and she's actually got, I mean, probably almost similar in age. And she's like, I want to be right here, right now. Like, I'm not thinking of anything else. It is, I love working with Kelly. I love working with these grapes. I love the terroir. And everyone always gives a different answer. But I'm curious, 5-10 years from now, where do you see yourself?
You know, honestly, I couldn't give you a direct, like a straight answer for that, because I don't know where I'll be.
Yeah.
But hopefully wherever I am, I'm going to be, you know, kind of, you know, living the same kind of life that I'm living now, where I'm kind of like doing what I imagined doing, you know, while I was in school, you know, which is being a winemaker, you know, coming in, making wine, having folks enjoy it, having the family all, you know, support what I'm doing. So
is there one wine here that you're really excited about, either this vintage or another one that hasn't been released? Is there one of the wines, maybe the Pinot, we haven't even talked about that, but is there one of the wines you're like, I can't wait to try you again?
So we're working on a new wine this year that we have never made before. So we're resurrecting an old label for it. I think it used to be a red wine, but we're actually making like a field blend white wine this year. It's got a little bit of like old vintage wine, like kind of blended into it as well. I'm going to be vague on purpose.
That's fine. I won't put you.
But yesterday, Derek was up, obviously. You interviewed him yesterday, and we tasted through all the wines that we have sitting in the building right now. And we tasted that wine, and both of us were just flabbergasted at like how amazing that wine was.
Cool.
So very excited about that. It's going to be a very limited release. I think we're planning on tucking it into a barrel at some point, too. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a very wild, crazy, interesting wine, and very excited about that.
What I love about that answer, Spencer, is this whole thing started with you talking about that you're a nerd. And you could have gone with, oh, I'm excited about a Pinot. You're in the county. That would be a classic answer. Or I'm excited about one of the Bordeaux blends. You went with a white field blend as the one that really got you flabbergasted. A fantastic wine nerdy answer. Hey, Spencer, I really appreciate you doing this. This was fantastic chatting with you, and it's been fantastic the last couple of days, just getting to know everyone here, from Sachs and Sherry and Derek. You know, the love for Richard. I said, "Oh, I'm good. Why am I now? Even I'm getting a little choked up." Do you know why? Because when we talked to Sachs weeks and weeks ago, he told us a whole story, and Amy and me and her sister, we're sitting in the car trying not to cry, because it's a sad story. It's an emotional story, but it's also a wonderful story. And I think all you guys, I think you guys have done him proud. I think you've done the county proud. These are great wines, and I appreciate it. Thanks for doing it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me at Spotify, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.